This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC. To avoid me, you're in Cardiff today, Mr.
I'm going far and wide. No, it's lovely.
Okay, no, I don't doubt it. Will I ever see you in London again, Mr. Clegg?
Well, that depends.
We have to wait.
14 days' time, doesn't
it? Yes, indeed. Let's hope that perhaps we can fit in one visit. Let's go straight to the calls to the leader of the Lib Dems and Deputy Prime Minister Nick Clegg. First up, Anna in Hackney. Anna, you're through to Nick Clegg. Go ahead, Anna.
Hi, Nick.
Hello, Anna.
I wanted to ask you a question about the human tragedy we're seeing unfolding in the Mediterranean. Good flag, actually. I work for the Refugee Council.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been in following what you're saying on this with interest. You've talked about a multi-pronged approach to dealing with the crisis by tackling instability in the countries that people are fleeing from. Obviously, that's really important, but it's a very long-term aim.
Mm-hmm.
In the meantime, people are obviously going to continue to flee places like Syria and Eritrea.
Mm.
Do you agree there's an urgent need to address the underlying problem, that the reason people are forced to put their lives into the hands of smugglers is because there are no safe and legal routes for refugees to access safety in Europe? And there are two things that I think Britain could do immediately. One is we could commit to resettling far more refugees than we currently do. And secondly, we could change the rules to make it much easier for refugees to reunite with their loved ones who are already living in safety in the UK. Hoping for your thoughts.
So, Anna, do I think that we should look at, as Europe, how we try and help the most wretched, the most desperate, who are fleeing from violence, who are fleeing from persecution? Of course, that's something which is ingrained in our history, in our traditions. We are, as you know better than I do, duty bound legally under international law to. Help and provide refuge to people who are genuinely sort of fleeing violence and persecution. Do I, however, and I'm sure you're not suggesting this, but do I think that even if we were to do more of that, and as over time we are doing more of that, there are various schemes, as you know, which are seeking to help those who are fleeing from Syria. But even if we were to do more of that, could we absorb all of those people who are fleeing their villages, their communities, their hamlets, their cities that are being bombed to smithereens? No, clearly not. And at the end of the day, as you quite rightly say, it's Eritreans and Syrians who make up the bulk of those people who are trying to cross the Mediterranean and are perishing in the Mediterranean. At the end of the day, the reason why that's happening is that there are wars raging in their home countries. And that, of course, remains the genesis of this problem, one that we can't solve from the outside world. We can try and bear down on the smugglers, alleviate the worst forms of suffering, give huge amount of aid and assistance in those countries to help keep those who are being displaced in country. But as you said at the outset, all of those things should be tried. It is a multi-pronged approach. But at the end of the day, it's the sort of furnace of conflict that is driving this.
Absolutely. But the reality is that people are turning to those people smugglers because they have no safe way to get to safety. If we saw an EU-wide much greater commitment on resettlement, that would be one safe and legal route to safety. And the UK has a particularly poor record on this. While we actually our programmes are excellent programmes and absolutely life-changing for those very few people who make it to the UK, the numbers are really pathetic. We're talking about 143 Syrians having been resettled in the UK since the start of the conflict.
Mm.
And in terms of other groups, we only resettle around 750 refugees worldwide.
Yeah.
And I'll give you another example.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a Syrian mother and you're living in safety in the UK, but you have a daughter who's escaped perhaps to Lebanon, living in dire circumstances, barely able to get, potentially not able to feed herself and at risk every day, and you're probably desperately worried about her. If she's 19 years old, it will be extremely hard for her to join her mother here in the UK. Her only chance will probably be to make that incredibly dangerous journey across land and then over the Mediterranean. There's an urgent need to look at some of those to ensure that we're making it easier for people to access safety in the UK, particularly where there's that connection in place.
Sure. So, Anna, as you know, I first, in the face of considerable resistance in parts of Whitehall, insisted that we do initiate our Syrian resettlement programme. You're right, the numbers in that programme are quite small. They will grow, and they must grow, because they should.
That's 140, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. They will grow, and of course that's... And they're not. It's not the only schemes, you know. There are other schemes as well. But I totally accept that if it was just 140 people, that would be, you know, that would be a pretty miserly contribution from the UK.
The UN are saying we should take 14,000 a year for 5 years. That is in the view of the special rapporteur on human rights.
Well, I just don't agree with... I guess... Let me go back to what I said to Anna at the outset. Mm. We can, of course, talk, you know, lots and lots of numbers. I totally accept Anna's central assertion that the scheme we've got is a great scheme, but it needs to be, you know, it needs to help more people, as it will, as it's designed to do as well. Of course it is. But do I think that these resettlement programmes on their own are the solution? They're clearly not. And in a sense, no resettlement programme is ever going to be big enough to deal with the potential numbers of people who are fleeing this horrific conflict, particularly in Syria. I mean, the whole country is just descended into chaos. And so we're never going to keep up. I accept Anna's suggestion that the existing resettlement programme should, as it will, expand, but we're never going to keep up with the numbers of people who potentially want to flee from their home, which is why, at the end of the day... Well, that is why, in the awful sort of jargon, it is a multi-pronged approach. And I think, by the way, the fact that we are by far the world's... After the Americans, we're now the world's largest donor of assistance and emergency aid and humanitarian assistance to millions of people in Syria and in that region. It's something which should make us very
proud. But they
still
want to come here. Is 14,000 the right figure, as Professor Grippo suggests?
Do you know? I think you can come up with a whole range of figures.
Would you be happy with 14,000?
Actually, as it happens, I don't think just sort of plucking 14,000 out of the air and saying that's going to provide.
He's a special rapporteur for the UN.
OK, well, I respectfully disagree with the idea that therefore, is the solution. It is not, because, as I said at the outset, the real problem is that you have an almost infinite number of people who, quite understandably, want to flee the brutal violence which they and their families and their communities are being subject to. And that, of course, is why I think the focus must remain, as it does, on the very, very considerable millions of... I think it's now the largest... largest project of humanitarian aid and assistance that our country has ever undertaken is in Syria, and that is right, because that is where
but
can make
the... But
it's
not just Syrians, is it? It's Eritreans. There's all sorts of people who are trying to cross the water, Deputy Prime Minister.
Indeed it is.
So in the light of that, the decision to end that search and rescue mission last autumn, which you and the Prime Minister pushed, that was a wrong call, wasn't it?
I think it was, with hindsight. I mean, if I can just be quite specific, the Italians, who are at the front line in all of this, they said that sending out rescue and search and rescue missions, by the way, particularly deep into Libyan waters, was acting as an incentive, because then, in a sense, the smugglers only needed to go out a few miles out into sea from the Libyan coast, in the knowledge that the people would be picked up. So I don't think it was... I mean, one can always be very wise with hindsight, but when the Italians themselves said, look, we want to change tack, it would have been very odd for Britain, if you like, from a much greater distance to say, no, you can't. Right. So, of course, that was a decision led by the Italians and others. That clearly has led to a totally unacceptable, morally unacceptable situation. All I'm saying is that we're never going to find a solution, either at sea or by banding around numbers of people who we allow to resettle, because we have to do a lot of things at the same time, most especially helping those people in their communities and in their countries where the violence is raging right now.
There's a related question. John's in Eastbourne. You're through to Mr. Craig. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, good morning, Nick. I would just like to say, obviously, we want to remain, if we can, a compassionate nation, same as all of Europe, you know? And I've just two quick points I'd like to make. One is, obviously, Libya and Iraq are both oil-rich countries, and it's just a terrible shame that all these years they've been selling billions of barrels of oil, and obviously their own people have not benefited from that at all. Both the countries are now obviously in a terrible state, smashed to pieces. Mm. And, you know, obviously there must be some kind of limit, though, to how many people we can actually take into Europe, because obviously this, you know, there are just limitless numbers that want to come here, isn't there?
Well,
what is the answer? There is no solution, really, is there?
Well, John, look, I mean, first, I accept your assertion that, in a sense, that it isn't really, at the end of the day, a kind of you know, here's an ideal number of people who resettle to Europe, and there's a number that is not ideal. You're right to say that we live in a very insecure, unsafe world where there are a lot of conflicts raging. Our neighbourhood, our neck of the woods, Europe, is adjacent to some of the most vicious conflicts we've seen anywhere in the world since, you know, for a generation or two, and they are creating this sort of domino effect of instability in the region, which is dangerous. We're seeing this increasingly bloody conflict between the Shia and Sunni Muslim communities in parts of in parts of Iraq, as you can see, and in Syria and elsewhere. It is a very, you know, it's a very dangerous time, and that is why I think, A, we need to be compassionate. B, we need to use our wealth and our clout through aid and assistance to try and help those people who are being displaced. We need to do everything we can to bring an end to the conflict. And we need to remain united with our European partners and indeed with the Americans. And if we can do all of those things, we can try and keep ourselves safe and also act compassionately. But you're right, John, it's not straightforward. And it's a very difficult balance to strike.
I suppose the final part of that question is, when will Britain be full?
When will Britain be full? What, because of these conflicts? I don't think the conflicts
will
in Eritrea
and Syria. Where we simply we have a housing crisis, as you'll be aware. Mm. Mm. Would there be a time when Britain simply cannot take any more people?
I don't, as it happens, and Anna was highlighting that some of the resettlement schemes have only resettled a very small number of individuals. So I don't think, if that's what you're suggesting, that there's any link between the number of Syrians and Eritreans coming into the United Kingdom and the overall pressure on the housing market. The overall pressure on housing is, as we've discussed this before, is actually nothing to do with Syria and Eritrea. It's to do with the fact we haven't built nearly enough houses as a country for government after government after government. And we need to now build close to 300,000 homes a year, every year, for many years in order to keep up with the amount of demand now on our housing.
This is Nick Ferrari with more to come as I look back at my week on Breakfast. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on Breakfast here on LBC. Mr. Mayor, welcome to the programme.
Good morning, Nick. So this is your show, not my show.
This is my show, not your show for once. Yes, I know, it's all changed during the election. So, on the weekend, you talked about a battle for Britain. You talked about the need to ensure that your followers and others vote Conservative. They even wheeled Sir John Major away from the cricket. They dragged him away from the cricket yesterday. He became Mystic Major and said that there'd be all sorts of doom if Britain was to vote Labour. Why? The Conservatives.
No, I think there's a rally. You are rattled, aren't you? No, absolutely not. I think that if you look at where we were last week, we were on average about 1 point behind, and we're now on average about 1 point ahead in all these polls. And I think that clearly that understates the Conservative position. I think people are looking at the big facts of this election, and as the days go by, what have we got, 2 weeks left, something like that? I think they will really drill down to the issue that it is a binary choice. Do you want to go forward with the Conservatives with a strong and growing economy that has been turned round in the last 5 years? And, by the way, with a Conservative election manifesto that I think is absolutely terrific? Or do you want to go backwards to Miliband and Balls, the guys who drove it over the cliff last time? And I, you know, as mayor of this city, which is, you know, the most successful urban economy now in Europe, it really chills my blood to think of those guys taking over again. They wrecked the economy.
It's a bit desperate, though, as I say earlier, isn't it, to bring Sir John out of retirement like that?
No, I think Sir John Major is a very distinguished elder statesman of this country, and he's entitled to his view. And I think he wanted to make a particular point, which is relevant. All those good things that we want to deliver. So, pushing out much more free childcare. There's going to be an announcement today by the Prime Minister to explain some more about the 30 hours of free childcare per week that we're going to be delivering by 2017. He's going to be explaining that. All the good stuff about helping you not to lose your family home as a result of death duties. More apprenticeships, all the good stuff in the manifesto, helping people with their own home. Now, all that is put at risk if you have a Labour government abetted, this is the point Sir John was making, abetted by the Scottish Nationalist Party. Now, the problem with the SNP is not just that they are not, you know, wholly devoted to the health of our beloved United Kingdom. The problem with them is that they are much more left-wing even than than Ed Miliband, and they want to grab the steering wheel of politics and tilt it sharply to the left. They want to borrow another 148 billion pounds.
Okay.
They want to scrap...
Why have you come onto it so late? Why has Mr Cameron used you as a super sub?
I mean, that's totally absurd.
Well, we haven't heard anything from you.
Nonsense. I've been out and about all over the place. And as local papers up and down the land will testify, I've been out on the streets. I've been making speeches up and down the country, and indeed throughout London. I stress, and before London listeners think I've been abandoning my city. I've been out and about on the pavements of London too. Yesterday, okay. day before,
and do you get a warm welcome?
I will continue to.
You get
to
a warm welcome, do you?
On the whole, I'm not going to. I don't want to. Provoke.
It's the most embarrassing moment you've had as you've been stomping up and down the streets of London and elsewhere.
You know, I let me just think. Nothing really embarrassing. Actually, it's all been incredibly good-natured, and I think people have been... I think the truth is, for the first few weeks, you talk about, what have I been doing. I've been actually out and about campaigning a lot, but I think the truth is, for a lot of the time, people haven't really been focusing on this election. And
right.
It's only starting to crystallise now. Oh. The last few days. And don't forget, that is what happened in 1992 as well.
All right, OK. Let's get some calls through on our election call. Victoria's in Holborn. You're through to Boris Johnson. Go ahead, Victoria.
Good morning to you both.
Victoria,
I just wanted to ask, obviously, there's a lot of resentment against the SNP in parts of England at the moment, particularly, but... Is there not a threat that this could backfire and lead to the breakup of the union?
Well, I let me just say, my resentment is not remotely against SNP for being Scottish, or indeed, they're perfectly entitled to their views about the future of the United Kingdom. They want to break it up. That's their agenda. My anxiety is that the Labour Party can only form a government if it is in coalition with them. If you look at the numbers, they are being wiped out in Scotland. They will need to have those SNP guys backing them up if they're to get anything through Parliament.
Yeah.
So the risk, I think, therefore, is that they will be held to ransom by the SNP, and the only way to, and as I was saying to Nick just now, you'd have a lot of really crackers policies on defence, on spending.
What are those crackers policies?
Well,
Mr. Johnson,
the agenda of the SNP is, as far as I can understand it, is to borrow another 148 billion pounds to have taxes which they call more quote unquote progressive taxes on top of what Labour is already proposing by way of increasing corporation tax, increasing income tax. So under the SNP, you could imagine some sort of super tax would be imposed. There is a kind of chop-smacking relish with which the SNP and Labour in Scotland approach the idea of, taxing the Sassenachs in London and the South East in order to pay for things in Scotland. And, I've got to be fair. We accept in London that we have a duty to the rest of the country. We export huge sums in tax already. London is about 25% of UK GDP. Yes, of course, that's fair. It's reasonable. But there comes a point when, you're being a bit unfair to people who are living in homes in London that have inflated through no fault of their own, and you're asking them to pay an awful lot more out of their income. Mm-hmm. So I think there are all sorts of risks in that approach, in the Scottish nationalist tail wagging the Labour Party dog. I don't want to see that, and I think the only answer is to go for a Conservative majority government.
Let's go to Steve in Stevenage, appropriately enough. Go ahead, Stevenage. Steve.
Yeah, good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Yes, good morning. In the last hour, they were talking about the migrants and, the problem of housing them or whatever, and, we've got a big housing problem here in
yeah, we
UK.
Have, Steve.
Yeah, yeah. And we're a bit fed up in the sticks, though, that the Stevenage is quite rural, development of the crop fields for Swift farmers' profits, So I really want to know what the Tory policy is.
Yeah, I can tell you absolutely clearly, I do not...
My question.
I'm sorry, forgive me.
Yes, he said the Conservative policy is for what, Steve?
It is about brownfield development,
yeah.
In particular.
Okay. Steve, yeah. My policy is not to let any development go ahead on...
So this is your policy or the Conservative policy?
And indeed, this is the Conservative policy.
Just which I'm announcing
ex cathedra. And there's a very sensible reason for this. The reason for doing this is not only to protect the beautiful aspects of the countryside and the peri-urban area around London that is, you know, the lungs of the city, and we must protect, and that there are all sorts of aesthetic reasons we want to do that. Mm. There's also an absolutely hard-headed economic reason, Steve, for not letting developers send their bulldozers through the green fields before they've developed the brownfield sites. They have, and the minute you give them permission for greenfield development, they will forget all about those incredible sites that we have across London that are only now being regenerated. Many of these sites, of course, have got problems of contamination. They're very expensive to remediate. You know, if you're a developer, mm-hmm. you're always going to want to go for the greenfield mm-hmm. option if you possibly can. And so look at what we've achieved in the Olympic Park, in Greenwich, in, yep. What we're going to do in Old Oak Common,
yep.
Areas that are complete, you know, that were, as it were, rust belt derelict areas that are now being transformed. And
Steve,
and being
Steve, let's get you back in. I heard you grumbling. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, hello there. I just wonder what incentives, though. I mean, I know UKIP, for instance, are proposing that there's some tax concessions that should be given to people who are prepared to develop brownfield sites. And I don't know why the Tories haven't thought of it, because brownfield sites, at the end of the day, are more likely to be in a place where there's existing work. The problem yeah. in the countryside is they're building housing estates where there's no prospects of employment.
Yeah.
So you're creating the A1 and the A10 and all the rest of it around here. And it's going to become a nightmare if it doesn't get detailed, you know?
Well, the way to get things going on those brownfield sites, and I can speak with particular experience of what we've done in London, the way to get it going is to get the infrastructure ready. And that's the prime duty of the state. And we've invested massively in the transportation to get people to be able to set up work there. If you look at what's going on, for instance, in the Olympic Park, where, you know, you had an area that was pretty derelict, we could have decided just to, after the Games, to put in lots of infill housing. Instead, what we've done is gone for employment, we've gone for a university campus, we've gone for a cultural centre and all sorts of stuff that will generate loads and loads of jobs, because that is what is happening in the area. So the tax concessions that we are offering, as it were, Steve, there are specific tax concessions in the enterprise zones that we've set up, but the biggest thing that the government can do, the biggest government spending that you can make, is to get the land ready by putting in the infrastructure.
Let's move on. You would agree that David Cameron is a very bright man, well-educated man, Mr. Johnson.
Yes, I certainly would, yes.
He was left stumped by a 10-year-old girl at a school in Manchester, Reema.
If you could pick one politician apart from yourself to win, who would it be and why?
Wow, if I could pick one politician, they have to be living or dead. Obviously, if I thought someone else should win the election, I wouldn't be standing myself. So I think I can't really answer the question about who else I'd like to win. There are lots of candidates around the country I'm very enthusiastic about. I think, I'm afraid, it's too difficult to say I'd like someone else to win rather than me. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here. I'm afraid I'm quite keen on winning.
This is Nick Ferrari. More highlights of my week on Breakfast after the news. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on Breakfast here on LBC.
All of them doing what journalists are put on earth to do, unless, of course, you happen to be Alison Saunders, the current DPP. Seems to think most of them should be sent to jail, or at least tried. They broke across three pages the story of a mother with two young children who's been allowed to live with a convicted paedophile as long as she locks her daughters inside an alarmed bedroom at night. Yes, you did hear that correctly. Can any of you see the wisdom in this? Social workers in Devon have approved what's known as a safety plan that's said to include the woman's husband, once jailed for attacking a child under 13, having to climb over her in bed to get to the girls. Yes, you're hearing this all correctly. Officials are said to be happy for the children to contact their mother using a baby monitor if they need to get out to go to the loo in the middle of the night. Now, the grandmother of the children, and obviously no one can be named for legal reasons, so Granny can't either, has criticised this, says the child abuser is allowed to move in months after it was described by social workers as a continuing risk. She tells the Sunday Mirror, "The alarm and the other so-called precautions to stop my granddaughters being abused are a load of rubbish. Since learning my daughter's new husband was a paedophile, I've tried to express my concerns to social services. I'm appalled this man was allowed to move into the family home with my granddaughters. Other family members also feel their concerns are being ignored. It feels like my granddaughters are isolated, they're at risk, social services don't seem to want to listen to me. Now, the man who's moved in has had to sign the sex offenders register and subject to sexual offences prevention order, banning him from unsupervised contact with under-16s. The Devon... Oh, my God, look what they call themselves. For the love of all that's holy. The Devon Multi-Agency Safeguarding Hub. Where do people think this sort of stuff up from? You can see them all sitting around in a meeting with fizzy water and glacier mints, couldn't you, thinking this up? What a load of cobblers. Let me try and get one of these idiots on, please. The Devon Multi-Agency Safeguarding Hub, comprising police, well, I'm not surprised anymore with them, probation officers, and, well, naturally, and social workers, agreed to an application by the mother to become an approved person. This allows her to supervise contact between the convicted paedophile and her children. Well, why would any mum... Dear God, once you discover... Look, unfortunately, families are breaking up more than ever before. So mums are bringing blokes into the family situation where they have a child or existing children who weren't dad. But if you... Can anybody talk me... If you were... Say you've got... And I haven't got the age of the children, and I imagine... I'm just speed-reading another piece here, and I would think, yeah, it's going to be because the children's mother got together with the child's abuser, a man in his 40s, less than 5 years ago. She'd split from the girl's father, oh, God, who moved out, first saw his children at weekend. He then relocated. He does not have regular access. What? The mother said, I am aware of the paedophile's past. He'd been a previous boyfriend in the 80s. This is extraordinary. The couple have now married. They like to go out for pub meals together. This is extraordinary story. What I can't work out is if you're a single parent now, single mum, and you brought a man into your children's lives, so you're a single mum, you've got a kiddie or a couple of kids, and they're below the age of 16, and you meet up with an ex-boyfriend because your marriage goes away, and I think this is all fairly common, isn't it? When relationships break down, you often ring exes and you go out and you have a few drinks. And then as you get to know them better, he says, oh, there's something you better know about me. Oh, yeah, what's that? I've been done for. I'm a paedophile. I have to sign the sex offenders register. Do you want to move in? And what I'll do is I'll go to the safeguarding hub, the local safeguarding hub, and I will put it in an application and I'll be an approved person so that when you come in and the kids are having tea, you can sit with us. The council tells the Sunday Mirror there are enough protective factors in place for the children. Victoria Clombier, I remember that one. Baby Peter, on and on it goes. Spokesman said numerous reviews by a variety of agencies have concluded that his partner, who wants him to be able to stay overnight, can adequately supervise him. Absolutely incredible that should have happened. Let's speak to Anne Lawrence, who's a barrister and also can speak about these issues. Have you had sight of this story yet, or have you listened to it as I've been going through it all?
I've been listening to it, and I was just talking to one of your researchers about this particular case, yes. I mean, I wouldn't like to get bogged down in the detail of one case.
No, I can...
There are many facets that we don't understand about that case, yes.
OK. Yeah. What safeguards do you think need to be put in place so that when, and typically it is going to be a woman, but not always, when a single parent, possibly a woman, brings people into the lives of their children to ensure that the children are safe?
Yeah, there are many, many factors that are at play here. And there are many thousands of these situations in our country, up and down the country, indeed, not just in Devon. Mm. What we have to look at, really, is the offending patterns of the partner who's coming into the home, whether these are a long time ago, whether there have been programs, whether there's been successful completion of things, whether that person has taken responsibility for their own developments to ensure that these things don't happen again. You're also looking at the family they're coming into and the vulnerabilities of the woman in this case, because some women are extremely vulnerable and there would be a red alarm bell ringing if someone came in who had an offending record into that family's life. And because the mother couldn't protect the children, given certain circumstances, and vulnerabilities are terrible things that many people aren't aware of themselves, are they? So that would be something that social services would undoubtedly have looked at. And as the narrative seems to suggest, it was felt that this woman isn't vulnerable.
Yes. What about the children, though? This is my concern.
The children are vulnerable, but it is the mother that will protect the children invariably, and it is a great burden on the mother. So she's obviously willing to take this responsibility on board.
Yes.
There are a range of factors, and it is both it's both partners really, and the children are always vulnerable. So there is nothing that can mediate that vulnerability. That is always going to be there. It's there in every single family up and down the country, every care home, every school.
You sound as though. And I'm not saying you shouldn't, but you're not questioning the wisdom of the mum's actions at all, Ms. Lawrence.
Oh, well, to judge, I don't know this woman.
But it doesn't matter. We haven't got her name, so we can say what we like, in a way.
Well, yes, it's true, but I don't really want to focus on someone that I have no idea of. But if we take
Let's do this another way, Ms. Lawrence. I think she's nuts.
Oh, I see. Well, but you don't know her.
I don't care.
I would say that there are many thousands of these cases up and down the country, thousands. We're not talking one off or two off or 100 off.
Yeah.
We've got to deal with every case, and social services, in their stead, needs to deal with every case. I, too, would question, and clearly social services have, or else they wouldn't have a risk management plan in place, question any wisdom of any mother who would want to have an offender living in their home, even
Absolutely.
If it's only overnight now and then.
Yeah.
But that's... The reality is that is what happened with this social services department,
isn't it?
They actually did question it, and they asked questions.
Ms. Lawrence, and I appreciate you don't want to go... You're absolutely right, no. We shouldn't go into specific details, but your argument essentially seems to be, oh, well, look, she's the kid's mum, so she'll be fine because mums protect children. Well, you'll know better than I do. Sadly, that's not always the case. You have some mums serving time now who do anything but protect... So we're taking a gamble that she's a sane mum.
I think, there's two comments there. Many thousands of mothers do protect their children very well.
But it only needs one, doesn't it?
But it only needs one, but which one is it? And I think we can stand here in judgment because of past failures, or we can sit there and say, are social services with the mother in partnership and with the partner, are they doing everything to ensure that that risk is minimised? You can never get rid of risk. Risk exists even if you don't know the person.
No, of course. No, I realise that when I go home today,
So what we have to look at is, are we doing all we can to ensure that risk is minimised?
Okay.
What you're saying is that actually the only way to minimise risk is not to be with that person.
Yeah, absolutely.
And if we do that, we've got like about 1 million people, 1% of our population or something, who are offenders, with hundreds of thousands have never been convicted, for a start. Who are offenders, and they're not meant to have family lives, they're not meant to live on this planet, they've got to be put on some different planet. We can't really do that. We have to accept that people are in relationships, people who have done really serious things wrong in the past, people who are at risk to others, have done things wrong, and are in relationships. Do we manage those relationships well? Do we ensure that the person who is coming into the family home is properly supported, does have treatment programs in place, or has done that, has shown some sense that they're able to? If not, social services need to look seriously at how they're looking at risk. And placing the burden fully on the mother, I agree with you, is not an appropriate response, because quite often people don't know their own vulnerabilities, and they do require other people to help assess that. But if they've done that, and I don't know, but if they have, then yes, we have to live with the reality that these are relationships that are taking place up and down the country.
And just lastly, I have a note here. This is an area in which you campaign. Why does this motivate you so much?
I campaign for better safeguarding protection. So my focus of this is to say, what is the risk assessment? What factors have they taken into account? Are they placing an undue burden on the mother? Or on mum alone? Or are they looking firmly at also the partner and saying, what has he done to ensure that the risks are minimised? And is that something that social services is able to properly mediate with proper resources?
Fascinating speaking with you. Anne Lawrence, thank you for taking our call. You're a barrister and you campaign in this part of this sphere. Sorry, I'm sure I'm wrong here, but calling all mums, what sort of woman would bring a paedophile into the lives of their two daughters, by the way, of their daughters? That's... insanity, isn't it? Let's come to or start our conversation concerning this. If, particularly if you're a mum, would you let... I'd bolt the door. All right, he was an ex-boyfriend. He probably was okay when you dated him and you, when you were kids. Your marriage falls apart. You start ringing, finding exes. Maybe his marriage has fallen apart as well. You have a few drinks. One thing leads to her mother. One thing leads to another. Then suddenly he says, oh, by the way, I've got a child sex conviction. Really? Sharon's in Slough. Hello, Sharon.
Hello, Mick. The thing is that this is just more evidence of the failing child protection services in this country.
Well, it's not failed yet, thank the Lord.
What, it's not failed? What, Doncaster, Haringey?
Oh, I see what you mean. No, I thought you meant... No, no, this particular one. I think you mean Rotherham. Yeah, no, that's right. Yes, I see what you say.
This is the same mindset that these people have, you know, because at the end of the day... The government have done absolutely nothing, nothing about the failing child protection services in this country. They allow it to go on in the care homes with the paedophile rings and everything, visiting the care homes, and now they probably paid for the alarm. You know, it's
yeah,
just,
probably.
When I was listening to that lady just a minute ago, you know, it's sort of like, oh, well, you know, as long as they're protected. They're in their bedroom. What about when they're in their bathroom?
Yeah.
What about when they're downstairs or in the garden? They won't be able to go sunbathing or anything like that.
Look, I agree. This is Nick Ferrari with more to come as I look back at my week on breakfast. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC. There in front of you is Ed Miliband. What's your reaction? Yes, Ed. Whoa, there you go. Extraordinary, isn't it? That is what went on over the weekend when the Labour leaders... Selfie! Battle bus was great crashed, it says here, by bride-to-be Nicola Braithwaite and 25 friends on Saturday. It happened up in Chester. After a while, the bride-to-be was allowed on the bus and came off a few moments later. And one of the hen party, Anna Heaford, reports the Daily Mail, tweeted... The stripper had just arrived for Nicola Braithwaite's hen do, hashtag Ed Miliband. Well, that hen, Anna Heaford, is with me now in the studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, have you had a nice weekend?
Yes, just about recovered, I think.
Have you sobered up?
Nearly.
All right, talk us through the... She looks lovely, by the way, your friend, so we wish her happy, happy time. When is the marriage? When does
June. She's getting married.
Good luck to her. I'm sure it'll be wonderful. Talk us through the chronology. When did you realise that Mr. Miliband was rocking up? How did it all happen?
Well, one of the hens went outside for a cigarette. And noticed his campaign bus, came running inside and said, Ed Miliband's campaign bus is outside. Obviously, you're on a hen do, you've had a couple of cheeky cocktails.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, of course, we all spilled out of the hotel and just started chanting to get him off the bus.
Yes.
And which he eventually did.
What sort of time of day was it?
It was probably about 6 o'clock in the evening.
I see. So there have been two or three Lambruscos by then,
yes, I imagine. Had, yes.
Okay. How long did you have to chant for?
Not that long, actually.
Right. And then what happened?
Well, one of the security came out, said that Nicola, who was the one who's getting married, was allowed on so that he could congratulate her. But obviously that was outrage. What about the rest of us? So we were chanting, Ed, until he came off. But bless him, he looked terrified.
Did he?
Absolutely terrified. And he wouldn't actually come off the bus. He was just kind of lingering on the steps, like, waving sort of tentatively.
Yes, I could see it. I've just been shown video. Did you shoot this video?
No, it was somebody shot it on their iPad from Chester paper, I think.
So there we go. So, oh, wow, yes. And he won't actually get off the bus, will he?
No.
How much fun was he?
I mean, he wasn't hilarious, I've got to say.
He wasn't that much fun.
But I think he was kind of intimidated by the cackle of all of us screaming at him.
How long did it go on? How long before you let him go? Or did one of his handlers eventually bolt?
Yeah, they sort of...
Enough.
Yeah. And actually, there was a woman who looked quite ferocious. And I heard her kept saying to the security, have you got this under control? Have you got this under control? Which I don't think they really did, to be honest.
And then off you went. You went back to your partying.
Yeah, and that was it.
Well, no, it's been very kind of you coming down. I have a final question to ask you, actually. And you don't necessarily have to answer this question. Are you aware of the high number of people who aren't registered to vote?
Yes.
It's something like, they reckon, 7.5 million. We've been doing some sums down here. That's what we do down here at LBC. We do sums all day long. There are around 64 million people in this country who can vote. No, I'm lying. So sorry. There are 47 million people in this country who can vote, of whom 7.5 aren't registered. That's 39.5 million people who decide the whole outcome of these elections, which we've worked out isn't a huge amount percentage of the population. You registered?
Yes, I have.
Why is it important to you?
It's important to me because I think it's important for everybody to have a say.
Mm. Okay. All right. Well, we're looking at that. Thank you, Anna. Lovely seeing you.
You're
a radio producer yourself,
aren't
you?
I am, yes.
Lovely to have you in the building. That's Anna Heaford, who tweeted and has been picked up by the Daily Mail and was one of the hens. How would you react if you saw Ed Miliband, and have you registered to vote? If not, why? Let's speak with Ramal Afflick, who's from the British Youth Council. Have you registered to vote?
Of course I have.
Well, you say of course. Why of course?
I mean, for me, it's really important that, you know, I take a part in, you know, having a say about, you know, where the direction of things. Quite often people don't realise literally how much politics affects their life. And for us, it's really important that we make that, you know, really relevant. So whether that's reminding them that actually, yes, politics is deciding how many clubs are on the street, you know, and sometimes people don't bring it down to those sorts of issues because, you know, they don't even see, you know, the fact that the council is deciding on, you know, on licensing and things like that. And for us, the second half of that is also asking parties to speak directly to young people. And that was why we were quite encouraged to see that Labour launched their youth manifesto on Friday. And of course, the Green Party were launching their youth manifesto this morning in London as well.
To those who say, oh, look, that, it doesn't make any difference, why do you bother to vote? They're all the same. How would you respond?
I think actually, you know, if you really have the opportunity to look through what the parties are offering, you know, there are variances. I think it is very hard to navigate, and I don't think that's a unique experience for just young people. And I think actually, you know, people do have a right to some extent to be disillusioned with it. You know, sometimes I think it's hard to vote for something and then maybe not get what you really wanted. But I think it's also important to remember that politics isn't this sort of instant fix. And quite a lot of the issues that we have in this country aren't an instant fix. It's no coincidence that young women, you know, are less likely to vote. And actually, if you look in Parliament, there are also less women there representing them. If you look at the, you know, minority ethnics and people within this country, again, it's no coincidence that they're less likely to vote. There are less, for example, black MPs in the House of Parliament. And I think, you know, there are some key issues there about sort of being disillusioned and misrepresented or unrepresented, which, again, you know, sort of calls for people to think like that. But I do think, actually, you know, if people aren't at the table in the first place, it's very hard to get anything done. You know, if the right people aren't there to give their opinions, then unfortunately they have to be made on their behalf. And sometimes that means they're not going to get what they want, and it's actually going to exacerbate the situation rather than be some sort of protest movement. You know, not being there.
Doesn't
really help.
How much do people like Russell Brand help with what you're urging us all to do? How much of a negative influence is he?
I mean, I think, you know, Russell Brand has his points and his reasonings for why he feels, you know, he feels like it's a broken system and all those sorts of things. And I think actually, you know, our political system isn't perfect, and it definitely isn't working for everyone. It definitely doesn't represent everyone. But actually, I think it's actually quite, you know, it's you know, you lose a lot of power.
I appreciate. Do you mind my asking? You don't have to answer this question, Mr. Affleck. How old are you? How old are you?
I'm 21.
There are many people who are 21 who'll say, "What the hell is that fella on about?" This is a bunch of people who wear suits or women who just dress up in outfits, and they shout at each other every Wednesday. Nothing they actually do has any relevance to me. They can't be trusted. They're all liars. Nothing they do ever comes off. They promise this and it never, ever happens. Why on earth should we encourage them by voting for them?
I mean, you know, by all means, spoil your ballot if you want to, but I think it's really important to actually, you know, to do something about it. You know, there's no, you know, I have an issue with the idea of, you know, of inaction, of just sitting around and being complacent about the fact that, oh, well, they're all liars. Well, actually, you know, I can't back up politicians and say say that some of them aren't. But actually, I think it's really important to be at the table to be able to tell them that they're liars. If that's what you think, great, say that. But to sit back and kind of and not say anything at all, you know, isn't doing anything for you, and that certainly isn't doing anything for politics in our country.
All right. Ramil Aflik from the British Youth Council, thank you for your advocacy, and now over to you. If you have not registered to vote and you couldn't care less and you won't vote, I'm not going to shout at you. I know you sometimes hear people say, oh, if you don't vote, you haven't got any right to take to criticise. Yes, of course you can. If you don't, it's, of course you should vote, but you can't be forced to vote. And why should you, if you don't like any of them, actually have to go in and put a tick in a box for somebody? That's absurd. So if you don't vote, you have no interest in it. Daily Mirror's gone nuts on this morning. It's their front page. Your country needs you, using that famous World War One poster, ... to vote. The latest figure shows the electorate size in 2012 at, well, we just told you that, 47 million. In 2010, the election, only 29.7 million votes were cast, 18 million people missing or decided not to vote. That's the third worst turnout since 1918, when most men and some women were given polling rates. So there is some excuse, really, there, because before then, of course, women couldn't vote, so that was fairly key. 7.5 million people are not registered to vote. Government changes in the registration system. Each person in a household has to sign up individually rather than one doing it for all. It means that 800,000 have gone missing since last year. Are you one of them? Or will you make a point? And again, I have heard people say, oh, if you don't vote, you haven't got a right to criticise. Of course you've got a right to criticise. But I'd just be interested if you don't. Tony's in Woodford. Hello.
Good morning, Nick.
Morning, Tony.
I think you gave a really good description to your last caller, where you said, you know, that people don't believe what MPs say, and you know, there's a lot of apathy out there, Nick. People are not interested, they're not engaged. And myself, I will not be voting, I will not bother, because they're not bothered about us, they're not bothered, they're only interested when it comes up to the near the election. David Cameron ducked an interview, you know, with Ed Miliband. I mean, what is all that about? He's supposed to be a leader of the country, he can't even be bothered. It's crazy.
When was the last time you voted?
In the last election.
Okay. So what has happened? Is it the expenses scandal and issues such as these, is it?
Yeah, it's a combination of things. It's the fact now that, you know, the NHS, you're getting these people earning in excess of £1 million, and the nurses only get 1%.
Yeah.
But what done it for me was David Cameron ducking...
Okay, I mean, one might say, if that annoyed you so much, why don't you vote for one of his rivals, such as Clegg or Farage or Miliband or whoever, one might say?
Because as I'm getting older, Nick, I'm becoming much more cynical. Mm. It's not like they're really engaging with the public, is it now? They're so way off the mark. And I think, you know, the system, the MPs should really look at themselves, get their own house in order, lead by example. I mean, you've got the situation now with Jenner. You know, people are going to be horrified that man's not being prosecuted.
I agree.
Absolutely. And they think, well, this is the system. This is how the system works. What's the point? What is the point? This is how people are feeling. There's such a lot of apathy out there. And, you know, the MPs are to blame for this, because the last 15 years has been such a kind of change. This is why we've had this coalition come around, because people are just not bothered.
And just lastly, to those who say, but this is why a few months ago we were remembering how people, actually a year or so ago, performed in World War II, and that they liberated Europe and that gave you the freedom to have your vote, and because of their sacrifice you must vote. How would you respond, lastly?
I would respond, the sacrifice they gave was a tremendous thing. But people now, they're just not bothered, and it's the MPs' fault that have caused all this.
All right, thank you for that. June in Wimbledon, some of the names that have not registered to vote are the fraudulent ones for whom this system was changed in the first place. John in Hampton, I don't vote, but I would if I was able to vote to develop a new system to get rid of the sociopaths running our country, and a system that worked for the people and not the individual. John in Hyams Park, I've been waiting 4 weeks for my son's national insurance number from HMRC so he can register, that's Her Majesty's Registry Union Customs, so he can register to vote. I've now been told by an automated message it's too late for him. Oh dear, how can young people vote when they have to jump over all these barriers? Seems a fair point. This is Nick Ferrari. More highlights of my week on breakfast after the news. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC. Rima won the Prime Minister nil, no, and Rima in Manchester is now through to you, Mr. Johnson, to ask you a question. This is 10-year-old Rima. Hello, Rima. Good morning to you. Thank you for calling the Mayor, Mayor Johnson. Rima. What's your question to Boris?
My question is, if you could take back one decision that you made as Mayor, what would it be and why?
Oh, brother. Let me just think. Rima,
looks like it could be 2-0 to Rima.
No. Well, I tell you what I think. And I've said this before, and I might as well say it again, Rima. If what we should have done, the Thames Gateway Bridge was the wrong plan for that part of London. It would have been meant terrible congestion up Knee Hill. It was a bad idea. But what we should have done, in my view, instead of just scrapping the plan, which was being thrown out by the planning. We effectively agreed with the planning. It's a very long and boring answer, this, Rima. But
she's 10.
I know, but let me boil it down. There was a huge bridge which we decided not to go ahead with because it would have destroyed lots of communities in southeast London. What we should have done is gone ahead immediately with a series of smaller bridges. But the good news is we're doing that now, Rima. Right. We're now going ahead with a series of beautiful bridges,
Rima,
which will really transform the area.
Rima, you are but 10 and you've bested the Prime Minister and the Mayor. What are you going to do with your life? Do you know yet what you're going to be?
Either a politician, scientist or interior designer.
Well, interior designer? Where did that one come from? The Super. Best of luck, Rima. Will you thank your teacher?
Thank you.
A great question and brilliantly asked. Perhaps I could ask one question of you, Mr. Mayor. There is a letter in the Times today that says the decision not to prosecute Labour peer Lord Janner over child abuse offences, which his family denies, should be reversed. It's concerns of a whitewash and it's damaging public confidence. How damaged is public confidence?
Well, I think it's very important that nobody should be under any impression that Greville Janner, Lord Janner, has had an easy ride from the CPS or has been in some way allowed to escape justice. And I have obviously some sympathy with the DPP because they're trying to, as I understand it, they're trying to cope with the fact that Lord Janner has dementia, and they can't see how.
In what way has he not had an easy ride?
They can't see how he could be put on trial. But
in what way has he not had an easy run?
He escaped prosecution
three times. Now, I say again, his family deny all allegations. He escaped prosecution three times. The current DPP admits mistakes were made and they should have gone to trial. The fourth time, sadly, it would appear the man is not fit enough to stand trial. Are you saying he's not had an easy ride? How would you describe it then?
Well, the guy has. Yes, I think it's obviously very, very, it's disgraceful, it's regrettable. And questions need to be asked, and there needs to be a proper analysis, if not an inquiry, into how we've managed to get to this position. It may be, Nick, before you come back in full frothing magnificence, it may be that there is a way forward. It may be that Alison Saunders can think of some approach that would allow the facts of the case to be tested in some legal way without, as it were, putting Lord Janner on
trial
the stand.
Of facts, as it's known.
It may be possible.
You would
come
support
up,
that
if there were some means known to the law.
Well, it's called a trial of facts. It's not like an unknown
to establish
practice.
To establish, what we know, and indeed, I think perhaps to go back over the question of exactly in what way Lord Janner is unfit to testify.
So you want a trial of facts?
I think that would be good. I also think it might be reasonable for people just to be satisfied, doubly sure that the medical disqualification, the aigrettat that is being produced is actually valid. I think we might need a second opinion from the doctors, as it were.
You'd like to see that as well?
Think that might be reasonable.
Howard's in Islington. You're through to Boris Johnson. Go ahead, Howard.
Good morning, Mr. Johnson.
Good morning.
Good morning. I wanted to ask you about your views on the national issue of the immigration.
Yes, sir.
That we are debating, perhaps is one of the most important of the current election. You're standing for Westminster this time around, so my question to you is not really in your capacity as mayor.
Yeah.
But in your...
Hang on, we can't get into constituency affairs.
I've been told
a prominent Conservative... As a prominent Conservative, you can ask Mr. Johnson what you like. What you mustn't do is even mention the town. That'll do. Yep.
Brilliant. Okay. Well, look, I'm sorry, Howard, on...
And your concerns for immigration. What, an immigration control, Howard? Is that what you were driving at, sir?
Do you just want a general answer?
Indeed. Okay. Immigration control generally, not to any particular...
You know, point number one, whether I'm mayor or London, you know, candidate for somewhere...
Whatever you
or,
might be,
or
yeah.
candidate for, yep. for Parliament, or just a human being, looking at the British economy, I have no doubt at all that immigration has been very beneficial in many respects for London and for the UK. Mm. And, you know, you just go around, you know, Nick, you go around... walk out of this studio, go into any retail outfit, go into any restaurant, go into any cafe or whatever, coffee shop, and you will find hardworking people who've come from abroad who want to make their lives here, who are paying taxes, who are keeping the London
economy... Have they stolen jobs
churning,
from indigenous Brits?
Keeping the London economy churning and who are paying taxes.
Have they stolen jobs from indigenous Brits?
What they have certainly done, in my view, is help power the London economy. That has had... That does mean... that we need to focus on. I don't believe in a zero-sum theory.
But have they stolen jobs from indigenous Brits?
No, not stolen, because I don't believe in a Colbertian lump of labour fallacy. I don't believe that there's a finite amount of work to be done.
So why isn't it British kids serving me my coffee or selling me my shoes?
And well, very often it is, but in many cases in London it isn't, and there are reasons for that, and one of them is to do with...
When did you last get a coffee from a British kid?
One of them is to do with skills. One of them to do with how people see their lives developing. I think it'd be fair to say in this country, you compare America. In America, young people in America regard working in McDonald's or a coffee shop or whatever it happens to be as a stepping stone or as something actually that is pretty good in itself very often. It's an amazing thing about America, you and I were there recently, is how people... doing a job of work, actually feel tremendous pride in whatever it is that they're doing.
Mm.
Here in the UK, we have actually a slightly different way of looking at things, and we think that these jobs are quote-unquote dead-end jobs or not, you know, a mark of a lack of success. In America, they regard them as stepping stones. And I think we need to have a culture of higher skills, of aspiration, of ambition, and one of the failings I think we have in the UK, and this is what problems we've had in London in particular, I think is the whole skills agenda has been totally mismanaged. We've had money being
mismanaged by who?
By the system. Money
or by this government.
By all governments.
Including this government.
I'm afraid so, but it was a historic problem.
Well, they could have put it right.
I just want to come to that. Thank you for allowing me to point this out. Thanks to George Osborne and the Conservatives.
And Theresa May.
And Theresa May and everybody else. We are now being allowed to... London is being given charge of the skills funding. So the £140 million available for skills for FE colleges in London is now going to be run by the boroughs, working with City Hall, to target it at those colleges
But this has suppressed wages, hasn't it?
Are producing the courses.
These number of people coming here has suppressed wages.
I think it has certainly had most economists would say that it has exerted a downward pressure on wages.
Yes.
Suppressed wages, however you want to put it. And one of the things that I've been campaigning for is a huge extension of the living wage, and I believe that this is a wonderful thing for our city. It has massively expanded under this mayoralty, the living wage. You have you have coffee shops in London that now pay it.
Yes,
you have coffee shops in London that now pay the living wage. You have more than 500 businesses that now pay it. Huge businesses that pay it. I hope LBC pays it.
If I was in charge, but I'm not, fortunately, so they probably do.
Well,
yes.
That's a disgrace. You should be ashamed of yourself.
I'm not in charge of LBC. I'm sure they do.
The answer is yes. Are they going to put their thumbs up?
So this... No, the answer is yes. I've just told you. Yes, I've just been told yes in my ear. That's why I'm saying yes. So what do we do with these thousands of poor souls who are afloat in the Mediterranean off Libya?
Well done, LBC. And I do think that is an issue. I do think people who work hard should be paid reasonably.
Okay.
So my answers to Howard are, you know, don't tell all foreigners to bog off.
Like Theresa May does.
Don't tell all foreigners to bog off.
As Theresa May does.
Don't take in people who want to scrounge.
So you are at odds with the Home Secretary over this?
No, I'm completely at one and on all fours with the government and
You're on all fours with the government.
just, I'm at one with David Cameron and the government on what they're saying about welfare. And the key thing, I think, for most fair-minded people, is that you shouldn't let people come in if they are going to leech, bludge, scrounge off the state. Mm. And so I think the... Can I just finish this? The measures that we are putting in to reform the welfare system so that they can't claim benefits for several years, that seems to me to be entirely fair and entirely reasonable. Now, to get those changes, we need reform in Europe. I believe... I'm not one of the pessimists who think this is impossible to deliver. Mm-hmm. I think there are many countries around the table in Brussels that basically agree with us about this. And we should go for that reform and then put it to the people in a referendum. And anybody thinking of voting for any other party but the Conservatives, that is the only way people of my generation, even your generation, our generation, Nick, exactly, are going to be able to the same generation. Did you vote in...
No,
in,
I didn't.
...in the 1975? No, nor did I.
No.
We weren't allowed to vote. You and I are about the same age. We weren't allowed to vote.
Well, I'll check your Wikipedia entry.
I'm all okay.
I'm a big fan of Wikipedia, as I'm sure you are.
Huge. You and I weren't allowed to vote in the referendum in 1975, and
so what are these poor souls off the Libya, off the Italian coast? What do we do with them? 500 are said to be on their way to the UK. How many do we take?
Well,
what action does the British government take?
The first thing to do is to stop the people who are trafficking in human lives, and to I think the sending of a warship or whatever we're going to do is entirely right. Myself, I'd like to see a real commitment to, you know, getting to grips with these people and rounding them. Well, there are people on the northern littoral of the Mediterranean who are actively conniving in murder because they are sending people to their death.
So you would send military personnel into Libya?
Unseaworthy vessels. And I think it needs a concerted European response. Right. And I know the Prime Minister is going to discuss that and to propose some British ideas tomorrow.
And military personnel into Libya?
I think you need to choke off the problem at source. You need to stop these people being put into boats.
Putting military personnel into Libya. That's the only way you're going to do it.
Well, you know, I think that isn't the tradition that you don't discuss the use of the of special forces. But, you know, you need to do something.
Special forces into Libya.
You need to do something about it.
Well, I'm going to say you're saying special forces.
I'm a long way away from the discussions about this.
This is Nick Ferrari with more to come as I look back at my week on breakfast. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
Start there with a story. More than 1,000 women with severe morning sickness have an abortion each year because their symptoms are so unbearable, according to research. Many are denied vital yet relatively cheap treatment by MPs who expect them to simply get on with it or end their pregnancy. The condition, hyperemesis gravidarum, which the Duchess of Cambridge has suffered during both her pregnancies, and of course much of the world on standby waiting for the successful delivery of her second child, affects around 1 in 100 expectant mums per year, 1 in 100 per annum. It's more severe than ordinary morning sickness. Some women are left bedbound or need to be admitted to hospital due to extreme dehydration. Research by abortion provider BPAS and Pregnancy Sickness Support has found women are refused treatment because doctors say it's too costly, unnecessary, or potentially harmful. Paper reports the Daily Mail one expectant mum who ended her pregnancy last year had begged her GP for a stronger, more expensive drug, but she was shouted at and told to get out of the surgery. Well, that's not very helpful, is it? Told to get out of the surgery. Beth Rushmer is an antenatal educator and joins me now. Beth, morning. Have I pronounced this correctly? Hyperemesis gravidarum, and if I have, how bad is it? Morning to you.
It's hyperemesis. Overdoing of the emesis, vomiting.
Right.
And gravidarum is the pregnancy
Brave.
Part.
You're right, I see. Okay.
It can be absolutely horrendous. I don't know if you've ever had a really, really, really bad hangover, Nick, but if you can imagine the worst kind of hangover possible, day in, day out, nothing takes it away, dizziness, constantly sick, can't bear the thought of eating, can't bear the thought of drinking, It can be horrendous.
Right. And there's no drugs can touch it?
There are some anti-sickness drugs that can help, but some women can't take those because they make them feel ill in other ways.
Do they harm the baby? I know the baby's not born yet, but do they harm the unborn baby if mum is taking these pills? Is there danger?
Well, back in, I think it was probably the 70s, if you remember the thalidomide drug.
I do.
That was brought in to help combat the effects of morning sickness and extreme sickness like hyperemesis gravidarum.
Yes.
And we all know the problems that come about from that.
Well, just to remind listeners, that caused the most hideous birth defects, children to be born with literally no arm, just effectively like a hand where an arm should be. And ultimately, after a lot of pressure involving the newspapers, I should point out, particularly the Sunday Times, the government made substantial payments, but it wasn't without the media attention. So just telling people what the thalidomide, because there will be a generation, yes, Beth, who don't know what thalidomide means. So, and it was told by, you were told to take it as a pregnant mum by the government. It was a recommended drug. Back to your points, Beth.
Yes, I mean, the drugs have come on leaps and bounds hugely since then. But I'm afraid to say that sometimes it is just seen as something you have to get through. But
right. How do you know you've got it? Because there might be a young woman, well, it might be a woman, listening now who's having a bit of sickness in her pregnancy. How does she know she's actually got hyperemesis gravidarum?
You would know, Nick. It would be that you could not bear the thought of being around food or liquid. The idea of anything going into your system just absolutely makes you cannot keep anything down. It's not just a case of feeling a little bit sick and nauseous and sort of not wanting to eat your breakfast in the morning. You physically cannot ingest any food and keep it in your system, which is why women end up getting admitted to hospital to have to be given intravenous drugs to give them the nutrients necessary to keep them alive, let alone the baby.
Is it a valid reason for an abortion?
That's a difficult one. There are cases, and it is possible, that the mum's life would be in such danger that she, to continue the pregnancy, could possibly endanger her life.
Stay on the line. Come back to you in just a moment. Anne Scanlon is Head of Education at Life, the pro-life charity, joins me now. Well, Ms Scanlon, we've heard the problems and it sounds pretty horrific. In your view, would it ever justify abortion? Good morning.
Obviously, I have huge empathy for a woman. I mean, I've had three pregnancies and it wasn't exactly easy in terms of being sick, but I didn't have this, you know, real excessive vomiting. So obviously my heart goes out. I find it difficult to imagine that it would get so bad, but I haven't been in the situation that you would feel that you would want to end a wanted pregnancy. Mm. I mean, I think what's happened is we've got so used to termination that it's offered possibly too readily. I don't know. It's hard for me to imagine a mom who wants her baby, you know, she feels so desperate. I mean, according to this report, there is medication out there that can be used. And obviously we need to do more research to ensure that women aren't faced with the situation where they either terminate their pregnancy or you know, that doesn't seem like a reasonable solution to me. I would find it difficult to imagine as a mom I could terminate my pregnancy if I was feeling excessive sick. It's interesting to know where the statistics are coming from, because almost all, 97% of abortions are done basically on mental health grounds. I mean, of the 180,680 abortions done under what we call the social clause. Mm-hmm. Only 73, according to the Department of Health, only 73 of those were carried out for physical health reasons. All of the others were carried out for mental health reasons. So, and that 73 includes excessive morning sickness. So if the BPAS are saying this is 1,000 a year, it will be interesting to know on what basis those abortions are being carried out, because it's not being recorded properly by the Department of Health.
Let's bring Beth Rushmer back into the conversation. Beth, you'll have worked with mums with this condition, I suppose, won't you? You'll have seen just how grim it is.
Yes, and I will agree with your other caller. It is quite rare to have it that bad. It's not a common thing for it to be so bad that you are hospitalised for it. A lot of women suffer greatly, do feel very rough, and I am in no way belittling it. But to actually have to be hospitalised for great swathes of time is not common. I think in my career, including my training, spanning about 10 years, I only saw maybe 4 or 5 that were hospitalised due to it.
So do you have doubts about the level then that the figures that are being put out, as my other guest, Anne Scanlon, expressed?
Yes, I think I would, actually. That number, what was it, 1,000?
1,000 a year. Abortions, yeah, 1,000 a year.
I would 1,000 abortions a year down to hypoxia gravidarum.
Yes.
Yes, I would have some questions.
All right. My thanks to Beth Rushmer, who's an antenatal educator, and Scanlon, head of education. Always good speaking with you, Mr. Haig. Thank you for your time this morning. William Haig, leader of the House of Commons. Details of that speech is later today, of course, from Sir John Major. You'll hear it all. And analysis, I'm sure, with some of my colleagues here on LBC. Let's talk about this abortion story, this claim, 1,000 a year due to extreme morning sickness. The headline says the misery of morning sickness. It's not regular morning sickness. This is extraordinarily extreme morning sickness. Joe's in Farnham to get us started. Joe, do you believe the figure?
To be honest with you, I believe the figure of the present side effects of real excessive morning sickness. I had it for both of my pregnancies. My children are now 23 and 26. And they did offer me something for the morning sickness, but I wouldn't take it because when my mum was expecting me, she lost her first baby, and I was born in 1959,
right.
And they offered my mother thalidomide.
Yeah.
Because the morning sickness in those days, it was attributed to kind of hysteria on women's part. I mean, they thought that if by giving them a kind of sedative, which is what thalidomide well, partly is, it would alleviate the symptoms of morning sickness. And my mother, because she'd lost her first baby, refused resolutely to take anything that she didn't particularly understand. And I can thank her for that, but I've got all my faculty of arms and legs completely.
Yes. Yes.
So exactly the same thing. When they offered it to me, I would not take it. Now, I tell you now, the site, how it feels, what that lady said about it being unbearable, where every waking moment, it is like hell. It really is. From the moment you wake to the moment you go to sleep, even now, the town that I worked in when I was expecting Rosie, my youngest, 23, I still can't drive through that town without feeling a really amazed, awful noise. But it's up the flashbacks of it.
Yes,
I couldn't go down into our vegetable patch again after I'd had the kids, because I felt sick when I was down there.
Right, right.
It was absolutely awful. But at the same time, I really can't see how anybody can want to end a pregnancy unless it's life-threatening.
Thank you for getting us started, Jo, and for sharing so much. Good luck to you. It's a great story and well told. Maria is in Enfield. You're on the radio, Maria. Hello.
Hello, Nick. Hi. Pleasure to talk to you.
Yes,
hi.
Thank you.
I'm just calling up because I had this condition, and with my second child, first I thought it was bad, but with the second one, it was unbelievable, to the point where I used to vomit blood. And ambulances were called regularly. And, you know, I had a toddler and I felt so guilty because I used to just be pinned to my chair. I was so weak and I was so scared. And I just felt, you know, is this normal or not? You know, I didn't know what to do. And the hospitals couldn't really do anything. They had a kind of like get on with it attitude as well. But absolutely never would I ever consider at any stage, even when it was vomiting blood stage, to end my pregnancy. Mm. And
can you understand
also,
a woman who might?
Yes, I can. Because when I, for I'll give you an example. So when I'd open my eyes at 7 in the morning, we'd say, I may have vomited 20 to 30 times by the time it was 9 o'clock.
Oh, my God.
And that's a fact. And my husband would ring me and he'd say, are you okay? And I'd be crawling around to my knees, and I was that bad. And I was trying to get ready for work, and you know, and I had a 1.5-year-old little girl running around. And
how did you manage? That sounds horrific. How did you manage?
Yeah, I just went through my life at that point from hour to hour and day to day. I hardly ate for nearly 5 months.
Right.
It was really bizarre because only on a Friday could I eat.
Why?
I don't know. My body just on a Friday would calm down and I could manage to eat a little.
This is Nick Ferrari. More highlights of my week on breakfast after the news. This is LBC.
This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
Dismal prospect of either Nigel Farage or Alex Salmond getting their foot in the door of number 10 is to have more Liberal Democrats in government and in Parliament to keep our country stable and strong and fair. So I disagree with you, of course. I'm going to have bags of time on my hands after May the 7th. But that, of course, isn't the hands of the British people. But I agree with you that there is now an increasing prospect of this really appalling choice between a sort of hapless Ed Miliband government dancing to the tune of Alex Salmond and a hapless Cameron government dancing to the tune of the DUP, UKIP, the sort of more nutty brigade on the backbenches of his own party. And I think that would be really, really bad for our country. It would lead to profound economic instability. I heard about George Osborne on the radio this morning claiming portentously that the Conservatives were going to get a majority and that they were the guarantors of economic stability. I mean, there you have two big Tory porkies for starters. They're not going to win a majority, and actually in their heart of hearts they know that, and they are departing radically in their plans from the stable, sensible approach to balancing the books that we've taken over the last 5 years. They want to cut for ideological reasons way beyond what is necessary. So for all of those reasons, Mike, my answer to you is I don't think either of those options are good for our country at all, and the way to prevent that terrible fate is to vote for the Liberal Democrats.
On a related theme, there's an email from Graham in Bushy. After May, will you be giving advice and what will it be to the new Deputy Prime Minister on his weekly call-in show with Nick Ferrari called Speak to Salmond?
Right, well, Mike and Graham, I very much hope that neither Nigel Farage nor Alex Salmond are the Deputy Prime Ministers of the next government. And that is the real threat. By the way, for those, I mean, there's a lot of tension has been quite rightly devoted to the kind of dilly-dallying between the Labour Party and the SNP. But, you know, people should take quite seriously. Did you hear yesterday on the radio David Cameron didn't rule out entering into a coalition and alliance with the DUP 5 times last Sunday? He had opportunity to rule out a coalition with UKIP. This prospect of a sort of blue-kip alliance on the right is a very real one.
All right. Talking about on the radio, the Prime Minister was inconvenienced when he was asked what the living wage is. He didn't know it in London and he didn't know it nationally. Now, if I was to ask you those two questions, you'd know the figures instantly, wouldn't you, Mr. Clegg?
I would, yes.
Yes,
I would.
Just remind me what the London living wage is.
The London living wage is £9.15.
And the national living wage outside of...
is £7.85, but I don't know quite where sort of one shape. What's that?
That one didn't work. Right.
No, but the living wage thing is quite interesting because, of course, it's arrived at by a kind of, I think, a living wage foundation. I think the idea of a living wage was first identified by academics at Loughborough University, but it's. And I think the way they come up with it is a sort of public panel where people kind of can make contributions about what costs they think should be included in the calculation. So, it's quite a novel way of coming about.
Let's get to other questions. Wilson's in Croydon. Wilson, you're through to Nick Clegg.
Oh, good morning, Nick.
Hey, Wilson.
Hi, how you doing? I've been listening to the sort of the campaign debate, and it strikes me that all the major parties disagree on absolutely everything. If one says this guy is blue, the other one will say this guy is green. But if you all want the best thing for the country, there must be some things that you fundamentally agree on. Mm. Can you name 3 things from opposition parties' policies that you agree with? And it can't be included in terrorism.
Sure. So I agree with the Conservatives with the principle that it's right to balance the books, but I strongly disagree with the way in which they want to do it, which I think is unfair. I agree with the Labour Party that it's important to make sure that we continue to invest in public services, but I disagree with the fact that they want to do so in a way which I don't think will balance the books. So, I agree with Ed Miliband that we should stay in the European Union. How about that?
All right, Wilson, you've got your 3. Is that good?
Yeah. Take it.
All right. Yep. Okay. Thank you. Paula at Swiss Cottage. Go ahead, Paula.
Hello, Nick.
Hello.
I'm a floating voter, although I voted Liberal last time.
Paula, you really shouldn't say that. Every politician from every party will now descend on your doorstep as we seek every floating voter in the last 2 weeks.
No, well, Mr. Clegg, I applaud you in your mental health drive for understanding, as I've got some very grave concerns regarding the mental capacity test, mm-hmm. which I would love to speak to you about privately, as I know there is a time constraint here. Mm. But meantime, my question is, are you aware of, or will you be examining, how if this test is delayed by perhaps another illness or hospitalisation, the enormous difficulties and dreadful limbo a friend or relative can face? I mean, unfortunately, the legal profession, the NHS and social worker caseloads mean delays can be endless or even too late if one tries to take another route to try and protect a vulnerable person.
Sure.
And I've personal experience of this, which is horrendous.
But Paula, forgive me, you just must tell me, there's so many different tests. Which test are you talking about?
The mental capacity test, which hinges on everything and leads you into being able to
access DLA and
every time. Yeah.
Right. Yes. No. I'm acutely aware that a lot of the tests are often delayed, as you know. The assessments made. I know this is not exactly what you're referring to, but it's certainly related to it. The assessments that are made, the individual assessments for people who qualify for DLA or for the personal independence payments, have been very poorly administered, huge delays.
Yes.
People feel that they're not being done rationally or sensibly. As you know, the government,
yes.
the coalition government's now replaced the people who were appointed by the previous Labour government to do those tests. And I think there is of course, there's an acute need to make sure the tests are not only done speedily, but they yes. are, and they are seen to be fair. Because, of course, any test, by definition, can lead to decisions that people, you know, don't welcome. I mean, that's the whole point of a test. You're making a judgment about whether someone requires this level of support or that level of support, or maybe even in some cases, no further support at all. So it is essential that they are seen to be done quickly and fairly. And I strongly agree with you, where that's not the case, it lets everybody down.
Let's go to another email. Wendy in West Wickham. Mr. Clegg, Boris Johnson told Nick Ferrari yesterday there should be a trial of facts regarding Greville Janner. Do you agree?
Yeah, look, I'm like everybody else. I don't want to. I don't want to be sort of, you know, jumping in with both boots, kind of interfering into the independent kind of decisions that the Director of Public Prosecutions arrives at. But just as a kind of, you know, human being, I have to say to you, I just. You know, here's an individual where there are some very, very serious allegations made, and a lot of, I find, totally understandable disquiet that he's not going to be, you know, facing justice in any way. But at the end of the day, you know, I also have huge respect for the independence of the judicial process, of the prosecuting authorities.
We could have a trial of facts.
Well, I mean, Alex Carlyle, a distinguished Lib Dem QC, was saying, look, there could be a process established which is totally independent, not only of the decision that's been taken already by the Director of Public Prosecutions, but independent, obviously, of political interference, which just looks at the facts once again to give, you know, to give a proper second opinion. And I have some sympathy with that, given that this has elicited huge, huge disquiet, which I can't imagine anyone doesn't share that sense of disquiet. These are very, very serious allegations.
As the Health Secretary Jeremy Hunt said yesterday, it's something, and I'm quoting, something very, very strange here, where someone, this is Janner, whose family I remind everybody deny the allegations,
yes.
where someone was signing official letters a matter of weeks ago and is somehow escaping prosecution for something so incredibly serious. Jeremy Hunt's right there, isn't he?
Well, I think I totally understand Wendy's point, which is, and I say Lord Carlyle was making this point himself this morning, that there is some way in which we could have a panel.
What about Jeremy Hunt's point? This gentleman was signing. Well, Lord Janner signed a letter to the House of Lords authorities requesting an extension to his leave of absence from Parliament. The letter was received by the Lords clerks on April the 9th. His signature, while obviously a man of that age, is perhaps a little shaky, does seem to be fairly comprehensible. So I move you again to Jeremy Hunt's point. It's very, very strange, isn't it?
I'm simply not. I don't know about the letter. I don't know. You know, I'm sure people with dementia can sign letters. I'm not going to start making. I'm not going to start making judgments about whether a one signed letter, in and of itself, confounds the judgment that the DPP has arrived at. What I do feel is, A, I totally understand and share the strength of feeling about this decision, and secondly, if there could be a way in which this could be looked at again entirely independently. And there's real integrity to that process, then I think that might be something that should be done.
And is Alison Saunders up to the job, lastly?
Look, directors of public prosecution need to make very difficult decisions. They need to take decisions without fear or favour. They need to be able to court controversy. But in this instance, I think it is essential that people understand fully and independently why such a highly controversial decision was arrived at.
Yes. I mean, she has had a lot of advice to proceed with the with the charge.
Yes, and as you know, the previous director of public prosecutions, you know, said that the case could have been, progressed back then. Yeah,
QC and child abuse expert Eleanor Laws QC, leading counsel of the investigation, both suggested we should proceed to prosecution.
Yep, and at the end of the day, as they know,
the DPP.
Yeah,
isn't it?
It is a lonely post, and that's why any decision taken, particularly one as controversial as this, needs to enjoy the confidence of everybody. And that's why I think the suggestion of making sure it's looked at again or reviewed again independently might be something which should now be done.
Tyler's in Norwich. Tyler, you're through to the Deputy Prime Minister.
Hello, Mr. Clegg.
Hello, Tyler.
Our question for you is, how would you enhance the everyday life and the future of the youth today if you come to power?
Sorry, when you say our, why do you say... I'm sorry to interrupt, Mr. Clegg. Why do you say... Did you say our question?
Yeah, I'm with a group.
Hello, Mr. group.
Yeah, I don't know what the group is.
Hello, Tyler and group. I think, first and foremost, the most important thing... How old are you, Tyler?
16.
By the way, I think you and... I don't know how old your group is, should have the vote at 16 or 17, but that's another matter. I think the most important thing for someone, you know, such as yourself, is to have a sense of optimism about the future, optimism that you can you know, obviously do well at college and at university and then kind of build the kind of life you lead, find jobs, get your feet on the first rung of the property ladder. And that's why I think everything from... You know, more than doubling the number of apprenticeships which we've made available is such an important thing. That's why I think the idea that I've been talking about recently of giving you and your generation help with the deposits that you have to pay for the first, you know, flat or apartment that you rent is such a good idea. Why the new rent-to-own scheme that I've been talking about, where you can build a stake of ownership in your home every time you pay rent, is so important. But also... I mean, more generally, I hope that you agree that some of the values that my party believes in, internationalism, civil liberties, fairness, making sure we balance the book so that your generation doesn't have to pick up the tab for this generation's mistakes, I hope that is appealing to you and your group as well.
This is Nick Ferrari with more to come as I look back at my week on breakfast. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
To Brussels yesterday and another of those emergency summits. They love them, don't they? The politicians come sprinting out of their Range Rovers or Mercedes or BMWs and they talk to their native press or media, give interviews, tight-lipped, then go in and sit there for hours. Everything you can think of, whether it's Butter Mountains or anything else, they love their summits. And they had one yesterday about the terrible plight of the hundreds of people who are drowning in the seas between Libya and Italy as they try and make their way, or to Lampedusa, really, to say try and make their way into Europe for a better life. Some of them are escaping persecution, prosecution, rape, mayhem, murder, torture, or just want a better life. Now, the problem is, of course, the numbers are growing, and last year a decision was taken, probably for financial reasons, to scale down how Europe would tackle the problem. Well, that's all changed now. That emergency summit, part of it was used to discuss securing a UN mandate to capture and destroy traffickers' vessels who board those ships. It would be the first time that Europe had taken armed action against illegal migration. They also talked about deployment of more ships and military personnel and increased funding. I'll tell you the smugglers' reaction in just a second. Here's a little of what the Prime Minister said.
It's right for Britain to step forward, for the Royal Navy to play a role. They'll be saving lives, not offering people asylum in the UK, but saving lives and taking them to Italy or to other nearby countries. That's the role we can play in the immediate term, but the comprehensive strategy is what in the end will make the difference and solve this problem.
Can I share with you a brilliant headline in a German newspaper yesterday? You don't want them to drown, you don't want them here, so what do you want to do with them? That in reality, as a headline is meant to do, sums up the story very, very succinctly. what do you want to do with them? Because when you get them, you actually want to send them home anyway. The smugglers, well, it's reported in one of the newspapers today, they're already mocking the EU's proposals. They'll say they'll simply get more vessels, and they point out that people are so desperate, the migrants are so desperate, that if they get the vessels, they get the ships, they will continue to come, or they'll just buy their own dinghies and try and go it alone. The going rate, by the way, is anywhere between $1,000 and $1,500 to try and smuggle someone across with these people traffickers. So what has been achieved? Niall Cooper is with Amnesty International, joins me now from the position of Amnesty International. What do you take from what the European leaders spoke about yesterday? Good morning.
Morning, Nick. To be honest, it didn't do anywhere near enough. It's basically a smokescreen. If the move overnight was not about saving thousands of lives, it's really about short-term politics, and that's the very sad reality. One of the proposals was to look at upping the amount of mandate they have around 30 nautical miles off EU borders, EU coastline. The issue is the vast majority of the people that die happen much further out. And the tragedy, really, as you mentioned there, Nick, was that last year there was quite a good search and rescue program. It wasn't brilliant, but it was better. And then this year, they scaled that back massively. And as you say, it could have been for cuts or other reasons. But that search and rescue program needs to be reinstated. Without that, then you're looking at where these deaths happen. Nobody's going to be monitoring. Nobody's going to be there to help those people. And that's the real problem with the suggestions from last night. It's the mandate. There's no mandate to really introduce a search and rescue program that's effective in the areas where people are dying. And you talk about when a ship runs into trouble, the time it takes, those matter of minutes, that's how quick a boat can go down. And that's the reason we've seen these horrific instances over the last few weeks.
What would you like to have heard from Brussels yesterday?
I think we really need to have seen that search and rescue program reinstated. We really need to have seen those boats, you know, the amount of boats, the amount of stuff coming through into the middle of the Med being reinstated. And without that, then you're basically going to be looking at a recurring humanitarian tragedy. And in a very sad way, David Cameron and other EU leaders really need to step up to the plate if they wanted to make a difference. And, you know, last night was all about words. It's all about short-term politics, not about really saving lives. And that's a huge disappointment from us. It was fantastic they all went and met and they realised there was a crisis, and that's hats off to them. But what they delivered isn't really going to make a difference.
The reality is, though, I suppose, lastly, Mr. Cooper, we have to look at the causes of this, which is the difference in the lifestyle that is endured by some Africans, and why they see even risking their lives as a viable option to get away from that form of torture, persecution, or whatever life may hold for them.
I mean, I don't doubt that for one moment, Nick. I think you're completely right. And when you look at the kind of the issues that we need to address with where the countries they're coming from and the humanitarian crisis that are happening there, those still need to be addressed. But what was important about yesterday, this was about looking at how we solve the problem in the Mediterranean. And there was a real obvious one, which was the search and rescue issue. And when we describe it as, what's the point of a hose pipe if it doesn't reach the fire? You know, they're looking at just 30 nautical miles off the coast. They're not looking at where the issues are actually happening, which is in the middle of the Mediterranean.
I will leave it there. Niall Cooper with Amnesty International. Thank you. Listening to that, Dan Hodges, who's a political commentator and columnist for the Daily Telegraph, and perhaps I can bring you in, Dan, particularly on the political side. Ed Miliband will today accuse David Cameron and other world leaders of failing to stand by Libya. That's contributed in part to the crisis in the Med. Mr. Miliband, who backed UK military action in Libya in 2011, will criticise failures in post-conflict planning and suggest the current refugee situation should have been anticipated. Dan Hodges, how fair is that? Good morning.
Morning. Well, there are two sides to it. I mean, Ed Miliband is right when he says that the British government and David Cameron are indirectly responsible for the death in the Mediterranean, because the British government supported and backed the decision to withdraw the rescue cover that your previous contributor was talking about, and that has deliberately meant that people have drowned. And there's no doubt about that. And indeed, David Cameron's announcement yesterday that he was going to deploy Royal Navy resources to the Mediterranean is an open admission of that. So on that side of it, Ed Miliband's right. Where Ed Miliband is wrong and is being completely sort of staggeringly, in my view, hypocritical, is to argue that this is all because of our intervention in Libya. Firstly, as you pointed out, Ed Miliband supported that intervention in Libya.
Yes.
And at that point had no qualms at all about the post-intervention planning. I have been unable to find a single instance where Ed Miliband has made a significant speech criticising post-intervention planning in Libya. And obviously, crucially, the biggest driver to refugees across the Mediterranean is actually the appalling situation in Syria, where Ed Miliband specifically prevented the government from doing anything to intervene in Syria, or indeed prevented the world, as Ed Miliband has boasted about during this election campaign, prevented President Obama and others from intervening in Syria, as a result of which Syria has imploded with all the appalling consequences we've seen.
Where do you see, what do you see David Cameron trying to do, or at least trying to look as though he's doing next?
Well, I mean, obviously he's finally conceded the error, the appalling error of withdrawing the rescue cover. But I think, as you said, we need a much more concerted plan. We do need to have proper rescue cover. We cannot simply allow people to drown as a means of disincentivising them from coming. It's quite clear we're going to need a pan-European approach to dealing with those people who are genuine refugees. It cannot simply be left to those countries who border the Mediterranean to bear the brunt of this. And then ultimately, we are going to need to have a European global solution to the collapse, the collapse of Libya, and obviously the collapse of Syria, because we think the reason we didn't intervene in Syria is we hoped we could isolate ourselves from the problem in Syria, and as we're seeing graphically illustrated, we can't.
Dan, thanks as ever for your time. Dan Hodges is a political commentator and columnist for the Daily Telegraph. Right, over to you. These thousands, well, it will be tens of thousands over the course of these next few months. So go to lbc.co.uk. Is this the map that the list? Ah, fascinating. Okay, so you'll see them. Why are they going like that? Yeah, a lot of... thank God they weren't in charge of the D-Day landings. That's all I'm going to say. We start in Glasgow, and you can see us. Go to lbc.co.uk. Perhaps we're trying to make a pretty shape. What's it called? A rhombus or something? lbc.co.uk. I think, fortunately, we're not in air traffic control. lbc.co.uk for our interesting route through the country. And also, I'm afraid there's my picture on the side of a bus. Yes, you did hear that correctly. Is the filler cap really there? That's a bit unfortunate. All right, that's as of next week. Don't miss it. If you're anywhere near Buchanan Street in Glasgow... Nope, me neither. But if you're anywhere near Buchanan Street in Glasgow, you be sure to get there. What are we going to do about these... poor souls who are drowning in the briny. Terry's in Forest Hill. You're on the radio, Terry.
Yeah, good morning, everyone.
Wow.
With these...
Hi, Glasgow! People, sorry, go on.
With these poor people coming over from North Africa...
Yeah.
What is the OAS and the Arab League doing?
Precious little, I imagine.
They're doing nothing.
Precious little.
Sorry?
Say precious little, it would appear.
It would look like that, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
And yet these are Africans, and yet they are also in the Arab region.
Right.
Everything seems to be coming down to the European community. Now, these people could possibly be settled in more stable Arab and African countries.
They don't want to go.
Well, what's happening in parts of... Europe in that case, like the invasion of, I can't think of the country at the moment, not Azerbaijan, where the Russians went in. And
do you mean Afghanistan?
Well, no. There's also unstable parts of Europe, isn't there?
Right. I don't see the point. Yeah. So let's try this another way. What are you suggesting Britain should do?
Get the Arab League and the Organization of African
States. They've got no interest in it.
Well, they have to make them interest because it's their people.
How are you going to force someone to be interested in something?
I don't know. That's up to the politicians, isn't it?
Right. OK. I don't know that we're really moving forward. Great guns, Terry. Thanks. Daniel in Hayes. Hello, Daniel.
Hi. Good morning, Nick.
Yes.
Yesterday it was a very short-term solution rather than long-term solution.
Right.
I think the long-term solution is we need to look at... law and order around the area where they keep coming from. To some of them, they come from a country like Eritrea. America, they need to be responsible about this situation where they put a sanction in a very poor country putting sanctions does really help.
I'm Nick Ferrari. You've been listening to the highlights of my week at breakfast on LBC. I'm back on Monday leading Britain's conversation with the big breaking stories of the day, along with regular travel updates. Have a great weekend and stay safe. This is LBC.